Leslie just started as our secretary a short time ago, so I think she's doing a great business. Good job. Best secretary ever. Costco Jim would say.
Except for Joyce.
Oh, Joyce is the best. We have all the best around this place, of course. Anyway, at this time, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight, Brad from San Diego.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep,
San Diego. San Diego. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, here we go. Boom, boom, boom. My name is Brad Crow, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I got to know, though, Craig, I might have to come back next week. Did I get that kind of a, like, when last week when they said I was speaking, did you guys roar like that?
Yeah,
awesome. Well, I thought about this for weeks and months, and of course, you know, here I am, and I have no idea what I'm going to say to you, so buckle up. I have to warn you, I have a nickname amongst my crew. It's Crybaby. There is over-under bets on how long it'll take before I start crying, so if you want in, talk to these guys. But if I do start crying, it's because, hey Gabe, it's because I am grateful, and I can't tell you how grateful I am to be sober. And for those of you in this room that have sobriety, you know what I'm talking about. I don't cry anymore because I'm beat up and I'm sad. I cry because I've never had it so good. And they told you I was speaking tonight, but really I'm here to sing. So here's a little ditty about Jack and Diane. Anybody know that song? Welcome to you guys from Arizona. Welcome camper from SLO. Welcome to the newcomers. Those that announced Freddie and Michelangelo and those of you that didn't identify as a newcomer, I want you to know that I'm glad you're here. My sobriety date is October 7th, 2015. And you know, the good news is that we're all here, we're sober. The bad news is that I there's chances I might choke in the next hour, and you might not get anything from this, but I'm going to do my best. And again, there's what we call a character defect, right? My self-deprecation is alive and well still, a few years into sobriety. You know, I heard John say one time, my character defects are kind of like on a conveyor belt, and I pictured like the old carnivals at the shooting galleries where, you know, you shoot the duck and that just keeps coming around. You shoot the duck, keeps coming around, and sometimes I'm shooting with a BB gun, and sometimes I got a shotgun. But that's all dependent on one thing, and that's my spiritual condition. That's my connection with my higher power. And for those of you that don't have a higher power or are still going on high-fueled ego, I can assure you that there is a God, and I hope you find whatever God that you can do business with. I mean, look at my beautiful wife here. If you stand up just for one second. Okay, just stand up. Yeah. I've known Hillary for 31 years. We met in college, and I fell in love with her the day that I saw her walking across the campus. And I mean, look at me, and then look at her. And if you don't think there's a God, you got to be kidding me. There is a God. And he has been taking care of this idiot for a long time. And I say that because, you know, I'm a recovering Catholic. You know, I was pretty angry at God as a kid. I didn't really have God. I don't even know where I'm going with that. I just totally blacked out. But and I used to do that a lot too. You know, the truth is, I could stand up here and I could spill my guts and I could just talk for the whole hour and I could say nothing that's going to keep you sober. Until nobody could tell me anything to keep me sober, and that was until I hit my rock bottom. And I have a pretty high tolerance for pain. I skipped along the bottom for many years. And, you know, that's the tragic thing about this disease. It's like, I get busted up for it because it's like, in our disease, we just don't see what we're doing. We don't see the pain that we're causing the loved ones around us. Our friends, my daughters, my wife, my mother. We just don't see it, you know? And it's just so tragic. And, you know, I've got a brother. I'm the only one still alive in my family that's sober. And my brother, he lives in Hawaii. He lives 50 yards from Wailua Beach Park. He's got a job at Pearl Harbor, driving a boat to the Arizona, talking to tourists, happy people in the sunny Hawaiian skies, and he is absolutely miserable. And a few years ago, I would try to tell him, man, you got to get sober, you got to do this, you got to do that, and just to no avail. And now I just tell him that I love him. And when he's ready, I could show him what I did. And I tell him that there's a happy life because I have never been happier. And I'm not always happy. That's the, you know, pie in the sky, pink cloud, you know. It gets dark. But when it gets dark, I know now through this program how to throw color back up into that cloud. And my brother's wife, who is a complete enabler and alcoholic herself, probably just texted us a picture of my brother, and he's laughing, and as he's putting on his gown in the Castle Hospital, getting 5150 locked up, and he's laughing, throwing shakas, and then the next picture that came through, he's passed out on a hospital bed. Guy's 59 years old. He's got two daughters. His oldest daughter has two grandkids. And he is drinking his life away. And it's tough to watch because I am so happy and so blessed, but only because of sobriety. I was a hollow, empty, scared little kid up until 45 years old. And, it's just an amazing program. And if you don't mind, I'm going to calm down for a second and try to gain my composure. And I'm going to read something that somebody read at a meeting on Tuesday night. Thanks, honey, for giving me this stuff. I didn't think I was going to need it. I'm like, I don't need it. She looked out for me. Yeah. Some of you guys might know this reading. It's a good one. AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life, and the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We do not and cannot outgrow this plan. As arrested, I was never arrested, by the way, high bottom, I'll talk about that later. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds, as we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line. And we find that we are compensated for a consistent effort by the countless dividends we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape from perplexing problems, we experience the thrill of challenge in the opportunity it affords for another application of AVA's techniques. And we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. My life in the last 10 years has been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments because that is life. But also I have known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. Ain't that the truth? For to these people I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing individual trust, understanding, and love without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. It's priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. I don't know about you guys, but if you don't know what I'm talking about, stick around and do the work. This is an action program. You got to, you know, as hard as you wanted to score a bag or drink a 12-pack or, you know, do whatever you were doing out there, whatever I was doing, if we give that amount of effort to sobriety, it pays off. I can assure you that. You know, and these guys joke, you know, with AA meetings, or we all get together and tease, or we all conspire, and then so when the newcomers, we can all lie to you about how great life is, you know. Oh, it's great life, it's great. All right. I mean, this is the real deal. Oh, man. I was going to ask for like 30 seconds of silence because, and we don't have to, but I was going to because silence used to kill me. I hated silence. My brain silenced. It just imploded with fear and despair. But now when I hear silence, I hear birds tweeting. I hear babies crying. I'm aware. I've been brought to life through sobriety. You know, I'm no longer dead. Living a dead life. And I'm a high bottom drunk. You know, I was never rolling around on a BMX bike with gutter bravado. You know, I never got a DUI. I never went to jail. Yeah, I know, right? My brothers did all that. And I'll tell you. But I do feel that I share the same common thread that we all share. And that is just emptiness and heartache and fear and sorrow and loneliness and all that stuff that we know. And, you know, I probably was a high bottom drunk. Well, I don't feel like I was very high, but I went down to the tubes pretty good, but up here. But, you know, I'll give you a little color. I'm a youngest of three boys, three hard partying, crazy, fatherless boys. My mom did her best. I was exposed to a lot. Drugs, alcohol at an early age. I think this is being recorded, so I won't go into detail, but I've seen things that a young boy shouldn't see. And I think the statute of limitations are probably over, but I'm still going to keep that one. But, you know, my dad, I have like three or four vivid memories of my wonderful father, who I think passed away a couple months ago, maybe. He bred three beautiful boys, and my older two brothers got a little more of them than I did, thankfully. I lucked out on that one, because there something went down that they are not able to face whatever they're facing. But, you know, a few vivid memories. You know, I remember, like, I was three, maybe. I don't know. It's all, you know, a blur. But I remember sitting in his dark apartment in a big Lazy Boy on his lap drinking 7 and 7. I know exactly what Seagram 7 smells like to this day, because I pounded his 7-7 out of a big plastic green thrifty tumbler. And I don't know why he let me drink. It tasted pretty good. I liked it at three. Go figure. Maybe it was because I was a spaz, you know. I remember he masking taped my big wheels so I didn't make noise in the apartment complex. I was like Danny in The Shining. I was a spaz, but yeah, that's one awesome memory. Another one I remember around that time, sitting in at I later found out it was a restaurant called Don Jose's up in Anaheim, and you know, it was dark and dreary. It had a low bar and couple of old sit-down video games in it, I think Asteroids and Space Invaders. And my dad, wonderful dad, gave me a pint glass full of quarters and told me to go play. I mean, I was 4 years old. I didn't know what a video game was, but I just keep putting quarters in the machine and, you know, doing whatever I was doing, staring at the video game while he drank and did what he was doing. And this one's a trippy one, too. I remember... You hear that song, going down the road, trying to loosen my load. I got 7 women on my mind. Okay, I got PTSD from that, you know. I don't know when that was released. I was born in 71. I think that was released 72. I was still on the radio, but I remember leaving the bar, you know, dusk time, and that song was on the radio, and my dad was pretty looped up, and somebody rolled a stop sign, and I remember him taking off and chasing the guy. And I wasn't belted up, and I remember hitting the side of the window and just driving, screaming for Dad to stop. And he was furious. He was going to kill this guy. And I think he probably did kill people. Didn't we find that out? He's a bad dude. And but, yeah, I hate that song, and I don't really like the Eagles because I'm not going down the road loosening my load, man. I am tripping out on that song every time I hear it. And it was scary. And, you know, and then I didn't see my dad for a long time, a couple years. I was about 9, and then I was walking into a golf shop, and out walks my dad. I'm walking in with my buddy Jay and his mom and dad. And they were golfers. And I look up, and I'm like, Dad? He's like, son? And I was like, hi. And he goes, how you doing? Good. Pop, boom, gone. And I saw him drive off in a orange VW bus with his new wife and some triplets. And I was just like, whoa, that was trippy. And then that was it for Dad for a while. And then giving you a lot of dad color because he did a lot of damage up here, I think. So anyway, my oldest brother, who has gotten into a lot of trouble, and my mom kicked him out. He was a Hessian, like a rocker, long hair. He's a badass. And I missed him. And I was about 12 years old. And I said to my mom, I had a paper route and washed dishes. And I said, hey, I want to take Bob to go see Iron Maiden and at the Irvine Meadows. And my mom goes, who? And, Iron Maiden, Mom. Tickets are $35. So I got tickets. And my brother showed up. I hadn't seen him in a couple years. He had been living with my father, who I didn't see. And I didn't know where they lived. And he was in and out of juvenile hall and whatnot. And I always kind of trip on this one. But, you know, we were going out the 55 freeway, and I was like thinking, oh, the 405 south to Irvine, where are we going to the 91? And I'm thinking we're going to my dad's house. And my heart was pounding harder than it is now, because I didn't, you know, I had seen my dad, and as a 12-year-old boy, you know, you kind of trip out on that. I mean, at least I did. I saw Gene Hackman on TV the other night. Poor man, God bless him. You know, apparently he had his father drove off and waved to him, and he started to cry about it. So I'm like, oh, maybe I'm normal. Maybe that shit does. Oops, I'm not supposed to cuss. Maybe that stuff does mess you up. Maybe I'm normal. But anyway, we go out to his house and we pull up to the garage, and garage door's open, and he's standing in the. He's a big dude, good-looking guy, I think. And my brother gets out. He goes, "Come on!" And we walked in, and there's a workbench, and my dad handed him a bag, and my brother handed him some money, and looked like a drug transaction. I don't know. Smart kid I was. I'm pretty sure it was. And looked over at a cutting board on the bench, and they both leaned down and did a big old rat tail of meth. And they both looked at me and said, "You're up." And I said, "What?" And my brother goes, "We're going to the concert. Just do it." And of course, you know, my big brother I looked up to, so I put my head down and I did some of that stuff. And I was up for like, I don't know, a day and a half, and I didn't really enjoy the concert. You know, Iron Maiden's great, but I really didn't. I mean, I stood there with like a bloody nose going like this for like, yeah. And so I really didn't have an affinity. I didn't really like the white powder. I had a resentment toward that for a long, long time, until my 30s. But I went for the good stuff, not that biker stuff. So that's a little color on my childhood and my dad. And my mom did her best. A lot of men showed up. My mom was a good-looking lady. She was the talk of the town, and I was a little kid. I remember slamming doors on dates. You know, "What are you here for?" And broke a few dates for her and things like that. And she was a good mom. She was a real good mom. And I guess I'll get into that right now. I'll fast forward all the tape. You guys know what happens to us. I graduated high school. I was partying, having fun, working, getting decent grades. I went to college. I met this beautiful woman. Had a great time. Lived large. We lived large, but I loved to drink. Loved to drink. Got out of Chico State and went to work for a wine and spirits distributor. Sold booze right out of college. Hallelujah. What a job. Sucks. Don't ever get into it. But anyway, you know, I was a hardworking guy. I was, you know, I never got fired. I got promoted. I was a good sales guy. I'm pretty good with people, I think, maybe sometimes. You know, eventually alcohol stopped working for me. It stopped working. It started just chipping away at my life. Started chipping away at my wife. My beautiful children, my health, and things started to get dark. And I remember, you know, we did everything. This, God bless this woman right here. She's a saint. You know, we tried everything. We cleanse. You know, let's do a juice cleanse. Okay. let's run a half marathon, but we can't drink for 6 months. We got to train. Oh, okay, I could do that. We did it all. Oh, let's give it up for Lent. I'm like, we're not even Catholic. Give it up for Lent? What's Lent? Oh yeah, I remember that. We did it all, you know, and then, you know, I just couldn't stay stopped. It was easy to stop. It's easy. Anybody could stop. It's staying stopped. And it's, we'll get into this later, but it's staying stopped and being happy is my goal. And we'll talk about that in a second. But we even did moves, you know. We moved from our house in La Mesa to Point Loma, where she was brought up. And, you know, I think that first round I was parking my company car like one time in the middle of the street. Luckily, we lived on a slow street. We were like on a cul-de-sac, but my car was like in the middle of the street, parked. And she comes in the morning and goes, "What? Are you kidding? Like, what?" And I'm like, "What? It's only like, it's right, the curb's right there, like only 12 feet away." Point Loma was fun. I could bike to the bars. Her friends lived there. I was getting social. They all drank. A lot of boozers in Point Loma. That yacht club, you know, a bunch of boozers. We moved back to La Mesa because Point Loma wasn't working. And then I took a job in Hawaii without even telling my wife. That's how good of a salesman I am, right, honey? I had you. My job sucked. It was the glass ceiling. I wasn't going anywhere. I'm not going to move to L.A. We're going to promote it. Honey, Hawaii will be great. You could retire. You'll never have to work a day in your life. We're going to go to Hawaii. I had already taken the job. God bless her. And but, you know, Hawaii was pretty fun for a couple years, right? Until I, you know, drank that one to, you know, my boss is intolerable and, you know, this isn't happening. And thank God my wife literally went to work. She kept her job and doubled down. She was traveling back to San Diego, back and forth. I was gone traveling the islands. My kids were alone. It was a disaster. And I had an unlimited expense account, and my job was to go out and entertain. Oh, boy. I walked around Hawaii with what I thought was a talus bone stress fracture with a boot. You ever guys ever walk around with a boot? Like, this, the bone's not healing. The boot, my bone's not healing. I don't know what's going on. You know, I went to Hawaii. They know about that stuff over there. I went to the doctor over there. He goes, have you ever, let me test your blood. He pulls my blood. He comes back 20 minutes later. He goes, man, your uric acid levels are through the roof. You got gout. I'm like, gout, whoa. He gave me a pill. The next day I was fine. Too much steak and whiskey and just crazy. So then we moved back. We swam home. And it's funny. That's where I went to my first, or no, actually in Hawaii. And this is notable. I remember going to my first AA meeting in Hawaii, Kailua Park. And it was a Saturday morning, and she goes, I think you need to go to AA. Because when we were in Hawaii, I did, you know, a cleanse, and I did, you know, I did more of the stuff. And I went to a meeting, and I remember leaning on a tree. Everyone's circled up in chairs, and I'm leaning on a tree like a big shot and thinking, who are all these losers? Who are all these losers in this park talking about love and God? See ya. Little did I know. Now I know that my ego is not my amigo. Little did I know. So swam home from Hawaii and got a job selling wine in the Western U.S. for a family winery. And I was on a plane and traveling, and that's where it got real bad. And I remember Hillary's boss is in the program, and he took me to a meeting. And I stood up as a newcomer, and I lost my marbles. I cried and sobbed and spilled it until Alfred, in the back, raise your hand, Alfred. God bless him, an amazing man. He grabbed me by the back of my sweatshirt, and he pulled me down. He said, that's enough. I have never seen anybody get sat down at that meeting, and I go to that meeting every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. And it was enough, because I didn't get it. I did not see what a Barney I was, what a derelict. I didn't see what all you see, living a beautiful, serene, wonderful, fulfilled life. I did not see it. So I went out. If I would have sat down that day and pulled my head out of my rear end and heard the sound pop, I would have had, 13 years now. But no, I went out because I have a high tolerance for pain. And that's when it burned down. I mean, it got bad. My beautiful wife was seeing a counselor and planning her exit. And I don't blame her. I don't blame her. So New Year's Day came around, and I thought, all right, it's a new year. This is going to be my year. I'm gonna do this thing. And I just remember being elated for some reason. I was ripped up. I was toasted. And I remember my mother called me. And it was strange because I had a beautiful conversation with my mother. And I never had a conversation like that with my mom. I was very intolerant of my mother, and I was impatient of her because she didn't think she was alcoholic because she drank Rombauer Chardonnay at after 4. But she drank every day and take Zoloft and Klonopin. She was massively depressed, and she called every night and told the same story about her past, and I was just like, get over it, Mom. And I started to intolerate her because I was in my disease, worried about me, myself, selfish, self-centered, kook. And I just remember having a wonderful conversation with her. And I came into the couch and I said, God, that was great conversation with my mom. And Hillary's like, that's great. And I just remember, this is going to be great. The next morning, woke up hungover and probably had mimosas and went to dinner at Hillary's house, her parents' house. And I got home and my cell phone had like 50 messages on it. And that's when I found out that my mom celebrated New Year's in a different way that I did. And what her celebration was, she disarmed the fire alarms and put towels in the door, and she lit a Weber charcoal barbecue, and she laid herself to sleep. And she killed herself. My mom took her life. And my biggest regret, and I have a lot, is that I do not remember what she was telling me on that phone call that was so great. But you know what? I gotta live with that. I gotta live with that. And I did for 10 months. I went hard for 10 months. And on my birthday, October 1st, 10 months later, I was towing a trailer up to my cousin Gina's house, who was tight with my mom. I was my mom's baby. She loved me. And I loved her. She was a talented, beautiful woman, beautiful painter. She was classy, and she had good taste, and she loved to help people. But she was sick. And I towed my trailer, a bunch of my mom's stuff, to my cousin's house in Long Beach, and had a bunch of wine at lunch with my cousin, who's alcoholic. I told you, everybody in my family who's alive is alcoholic. And she said, have you talked to your dad? And I said, no, because I had received a message through my godfather, who was friends with my dad in high school. I call him Uncle Mike, but he's not my uncle. He's my godfather, my Uncle Mike, a beautiful man, my Aunt Rosemary. And he had called me around April, you know, and said, hey, your dad's alive and well. And I said, I don't know what to think about that. And I had his number, so I said, you know what? I'm going to call him. And I had a little bit of coke left from doing some fun, you know, with my buddy Ricky. And my wife was in Hawaii working, and it was my birthday. And I got the guts to call him. I said, you want to meet? And I went and met my dad for a beer and a half. After that second half of that second beer, I was like, you know what? You're a loser. All I wanted was an apology, you know, some accountability. I got none. So I got up and I shook his hand and I walked out. And then he died a couple months later. But I'm over my dad, right? That's easy. It's the mom stuff that's difficult. But anyway, thank you, brother. So am I boring you guys yet? Okay, sure. A little heavy in here. Anybody got any jokes? Yeah, but you know what? This disease is serious. This is a serious disease. And if you're new and you don't think it's serious, just remember you're sitting in an AA meeting. The chances are high that you probably have a problem. And if you order to come here, maybe think a little harder, because, I mean, chances are pretty high. And if you are new and you want to go through the steps, I would love to take some people through the steps. I am just amping on sobriety. I love being sober. You know, I just, when Leo was reading my personal adventures before and after, I love that. I had some great adventures before, but it's the adventures after. Are you kidding me? I have had such amazing times in sobriety. I've climbed mountains with these two guys, 14,000 foot peaks. I've traveled internationally to Indonesia with these guys, surfing. I've had deep, meaningful conversations, stuff that blows away any good time I was having at a party, having a cocktail, talking about shit I could do. Oh yeah, I just do surfing all the time. Oh, I'll climb that mountain. Such a waste. Such a waste. And I know that now. And if you don't know that, I pray, and my hope tonight is that when I leave, that you heard something that resonated, and that you find a little bit of hope that there's a better life for you, and it doesn't have to be what you're living now. And I didn't know that. I did not know that. I look at this guy and I start crying instantly. This dude. I was in Betty Ford because my wife, on the 7th, when she got home from Hawaii, took me to the counselor, and the counselor said, "Well?" And she said, "I need you to go get help, or you need to pack your bags." And I put out my hands, right, pretty easy, and I said, "I'm done. Help me." And I was done. I was so tired. I was so tired. So I went to rehab, and I started my sobriety journey. And I have never looked back. This guy, Bill, shows up one day out of the blue and starts walking up to me. And I'm sitting in a chair smoking a menthol. I didn't even smoke. It was just what am I doing? And he walked up to me. And this man has changed my life, because I decided to set down my sword and surrender. I never heard that word, surrender. I wasn't going to surrender. I was a fighter. I was a tough kid. I dealt with a lot of shit. Sorry. I'm sorry. I have Tourette's. But, you know, I was tired, and I decided to give this thing a go. Everything that I was doing just didn't work. It wasn't working anymore. I mean, I couldn't get drunk anymore. I mean, I drink and drink, and I would not stop, because I could not get drunk. I would stay up late and drink bottles of red wine. I wake up with purple. I look like a clown with purple teeth, purple lips, and just miserable, empty. And in sobriety, I got out of rehab, and I did 90 for 90, and I got a sponsor, this amazing man, who came out to see me. He didn't know me from Adam. Who does that? Who? We do. And he said, "I'm going to love you until you love yourself." People weren't traveling 5 minutes to come see me for nothing. This guy drove, well, he flew. But who does that? This is an amazing program, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a game changer, and it has changed my life in so many ways. And I read stuff. I read this Keys to the Kingdom, and it gets me crying. I read, you know, God, the promises. Are you kidding me? Like, this is no joke. This stuff works, you know? But it's one thing, you know, and I want to touch on, You know, I'm nine and change, you know, and I'm a neophyte in this, because I strongly believe that this, like, just like the reading I just said, this is a limitless expansion, this program, if we put our heads in it. And I'm physically sober. I've stopped drinking, you know, and I've worked toward emotional sobriety. And I'm really, really trying to dig deep to find some spiritual sobriety. I thought I had it, but it's just limitless, because every time I think I have it, a character defect pops up, or I flip somebody off on the 8 for going too slow in the fast lane, or I snap at my wife, or, you know, for leaving the cap off of a ketchup bottle in the refrigerator, or, you know, whatever it is. But this program is like, it's a practice, you know? We don't just go to a meeting or read the book, do the steps, or go to rehab and we get out and we're done. We're not graduate students, we're gradual students. You know, it's a practice. You know, they call doctors and lawyers and dentists, they have practices, because they don't get out of school and they're just the best doctor in the world. No, they practice, you know, and I know how that's what I have to do in my sobriety. I wake up an amazing man, and I could say his last name because he's passed, isn't John, American League, John Bound. If you didn't know him, he's a legend. That man is just one of the gems. He said, I wake up every morning with untreated alcoholism. And it's so true, because I wake up every morning and I'm a dick, right? And I need to find conscious contact with God, and I need to ask him to take my will and just tell me what to do. As John says, what's the next indicated step? That's all I need to do. I leave the results up to God. And if you don't have God, I pray that you find some God that you can do business with. It doesn't have to be Jesus Christ. For me, it's pelicans when I'm surfing that fly by one solo 5 feet from me. I mean, that is God to me. That's my mother saying hello to me. It's a hummingbird in a tree outside my window. It's a song that makes me dance in my car. I mean, whatever it is, it's not me. As long as it's not me, I'm going to be okay. It could be whatever I want. And it changes. It evolves. But it's a practice. And, you know, it's funny I said the word dick, but it's funny. I used to have a sticker on my car in college, don't be a dick. And I thought it was a cool sticker to have, you know. And during COVID, you know, when the Zoom thing was popular, you know, man, we needed a meeting. And my friend Dougie and I started one in my backyard, and it started with three or four of us, and then it was 8, and then it was 12, then it was 20, then it was 25, and then my wife's out doing freak peeks out the blinds going, how many people are out there? And I was like, well, there's 30, but there's only 4 felons. We're cool, and they're cool. And but Dougie, after like the second or third meeting, and what are we going to call this thing, you know? And I said, hey, how about let's call it the Point Loma Men's Don't Be a Dick Meeting. And he's like, I love it. And we started that meeting, and now it's at a church on Tuesday nights in Point Loma. And there's, what, 90 guys in there. And if you want to come check it out, it's a men's meeting, 6 o'clock in Point Loma. It's a good one. A lot of good sobriety there. A lot of guys in this room go there, and love to have you. And you know, I don't know what else to say other than, you know, my life is exponentially better than it was. And I am so blessed with 2 beautiful kids that didn't want to have anything to do with me. I scared them. I left a lot of destruction in my wake, and I have to live with that. But sobriety has given me the coping mechanisms and the tools to address that and to take accountability. And it's still super hard to do because I'm an alcoholic. It's in the giving that you receive. Well, no, I want to receive. I'll tell you, that's all I want. You know, I just keep getting, you know, I have to continually fight to try to be a good man. And to me, that's what it boils down to, you know. It was time for me to grow up. It was time for me to grow up and quit being a little boy and a victim. And this is all happening to me. Poor me. I didn't have a daddy. Poor me. My mom killed herself. You know, I have to look at things different now. If I change the way that I'm looking at stuff, what I'm looking at changes. So to me, and I feel super lucky. And I can talk openly about my mom's suicide. I know she's listening, but to me, that was the ultimate sacrifice that my mom did. So her little boy didn't have to live the life he was living anymore. And I think that, and I am grateful for her sacrifice to me. She was in pain and she didn't want to live anymore. And she did that. And I have to believe that she did that partly because she knew that I was suffering too. I have to believe that. And I do. And I'm lucky because, you know, without, there's no hardship. What was I going to say? Happiness has hardship, right? That's what I want to say. And you know, as a little boy, I've always been taught to turn shit into sugar. You got to do it. But this stuff's heavier, you know, it's not little stuff. I mean, I had to turn that tragedy into triumph. And I'm lucky because a lot of you guys, you know, maybe don't have something like that to anchor your sobriety, you know? My prayer is that we all find something that we can channel and something that will keep us in these rooms with all these beautiful people. You know, how many of you people in here have 5 years or more? Raise your hand. How about 10 or more? How about 20 or more? 30. So if you're new, go grab somebody that just raised their hand and open up and get vulnerable. Set down your sword and stop fighting people, places, and things. And accept that you may be an alcoholic. And, you know, acceptance is the key to all our problems. My sponsor says that all the time to me. Whenever I come to him with a problem, he says, acceptance is the key to all our problems. And it's so true. But, you know, acceptance, if you look at it in the Oxford Dictionary, somebody pointed out today in our morning meeting, acceptance is an action word. You know, I forget what the definition is. I know what it is, but look it up. It's an action word. And, and the prescription that has been passed on to me from, you know, the men on the wall, from through my sponsor is trust in God, clean house, and help others. And if I can continue to do that, I might stay sober one more day, one day at a time. And, you know, these guys with years, they'll tell you, you know, people go out because they have too many years and not enough days. This is a one day at a time program. And I got my meat hooks and these guys that all have multiple decades and I do exactly what they suggest of me. And so far, I've never had it so good. So thank you for letting me share my story with you. I hope you got something from that. And I didn't even cry. Did I cry? Where's my money? God bless you guys.